Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Stories are about that. What's that? Today's show stories
are semicolon. No,
today's
colon.
Show. Story. I see. Got it.
Today's okay. Show colon.
Stories reckoning. Okay.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today.
Today's show is stories about reckoning with death.
Yeah, trying to beat it.
Or to cheat it.
And maybe hardest of all, because we're going to have to do this one day, all of us.
Greet it.
Yeah.
Or at least accept that it's going to happen.
Exactly. Now, first up, a story about death incarnate.
I think incarnate. Incarnate. If that was Tim Howard, our producer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I in here yet?
No, yeah, you're not supposed to be in yet.
You're coming. A story about death incarnate.
And the man who, well, who thought he could beat death.
Yeah.
Are you Anne?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. I'm Tim.
Comes from our producer, Tim Howard, but you're already here, so just start.
Okay. So, late last year, I took a trip out to Wisconsin.
Test 1, 2.
It was like that first weekend of November when we were out there for the live show.
Mm.
And I met this woman.
Anne Geezy.
To talk about her daughter, Gina.
Do you mind telling me just like where you're sitting, what room?
Crazy story.
I am sitting in the kitchen of my home in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
All right.
So anyway, back in 2004, in September of 2004, her daughter Gina was 15, sophomore.
I remember it was homecoming week, so they had all activities each day and dress-up days. And
Gina's a volleyball player. And one morning, she just starts to feel kind of crappy.
She started getting a tingling in her left arm. We thought maybe she had a pinched nerve or something. Thought nothing of it.
Then she goes to a volleyball game. Somebody, I guess, sets the ball to her to spike, and she looks up and she sees two of them, and she doesn't know which is the volleyball.
Double vision?
Yeah.
About a week later, she started getting flu-like symptoms.
She has headaches. She feels really sluggish.
Each day, she just got more tired.
One of those days, she does go to school, take the PSATs. But then the next day, she can't even get out of bed. They go to the doctor, and he says,
well,
it's not the flu.
So we went home, and then she just kept getting worse. Her arm started to involuntarily jerk. Her speech started becoming real slurred. Her body kind of stiffened up, like would get her up to go to the bathroom. And she just it was just really scary, weird, how her body was just stiffening up.
Anne and her husband John took her to a neurologist for some tests.
Just trying to get down to the bottom of this, you know, and what is going on with her, because the meningitis came back negative. Everything else they were testing for came back negative.
Were they running out of things to test for?
Yeah, they pretty much didn't know what else to do. And
a day later, on a Saturday, Gina's hospitalized. And then on Monday, when her pediatrician, who had seen her on Friday, came in and saw her.
And saw how much worse she was.
In just 2 days.
He was like frazzled, like, what is going on here? And then something just made me tell him about the bat.
Bat?
Yeah. So this was a month earlier. Gina and her family, they were at Mass.
It was St. Patrick's Catholic Church. You know, old, big church.
And a bat was flying around, and it was just kind of bothering everybody.
It would just, like, land on this, behind the altar, the stained glass windows up high. And it would swoop down, and it started getting lower to the people's heads and stuff. And there was an usher. He hit it to the floor. I don't know what he used, but Gina kept looking back at it, and being the animal lover she is, she thought she had to help it.
And so she jumps up, runs over to the bat, grabs it by the wings, and takes it outside. And as she does, the bat bites her on the index finger of her left hand.
So it breaks the skin?
Yeah. They washed it and then thought nothing of it. But when Anne told the pediatrician about this,
his face turned white. He walked out of that room. He says, "I'll be right back." But he never told us what it was.
They immediately rush her to Milwaukee, to this other hospital.
Children's Hospital, Wisconsin.
To be treated by this guy.
I'm Rodney Willoughby. I'm an infectious disease consultant.
And at the point when Rodney met Gina,
she was what we call stuporous.
You mean like she couldn't talk?
She could, but barely.
She was talking only single sentences, could only follow a one-step command.
She was in a wheelchair.
Because she couldn't physically stand.
Her left arm would twitch and spasm.
She would apologize, say sorry, and then try and get back into position for the exam.
And she was literally getting worse by the minute.
Within 2 or 3 hours, she had to have a breathing tube put in. She was essentially becoming comatose. The way she looked, I wasn't sure she was going to survive. And of course, if she had rabies, I pretty much knew she wasn't going to survive.
Rabies?
Yeah.
But if you are diagnosed with rabies, then what do you do?
You die, basically.
You die?
Yeah.
Well, like what? All of the time? Some of the time?
All of the time.
It's a really deadly disease.
In terms of the percentage of people who come down with the symptoms of rabies who die, it is the deadliest disease in the world.
The deadliest?
Yeah. Here's the bottom line.
If we say there are 55,000 cases of rabies a year, then you also have 55,000 rabies deaths a year.
Meaning it's 100% fatal.
Yeah. And by the way, this is Monica.
Monica Murphy. I'm a public health veterinarian.
And this is Bill.
Bill Wasik. I'm a senior editor at Wired Magazine.
And they wrote a book called Rabid, where they trace the history of rabies all the way back to the beginning.
There are references to rabies going back as far as we have human writing in the Sumerian literature, in the Akkadian literature.
So for thousands of years, we have been throwing everything and anything we can think of at this disease. And failing.
I mean,
from the start.
You see these very, very weird cures.
Desperate. For example, in Roman and Greek times, if you're a Gina and you got bit by a bat, you might have tried
eating a cock's brain, goose grease mixed with honey, the flesh of a mad dog salted, the skin or old slough of a serpent, a clod from a swallow's nest applied with vinegar, and then we have the dung of red poultry, provided it is of a red color, is very useful.
If those didn't work, you could
pull out the feathers from around a live rooster's anus and apply the anus to the bite wound on the theory that said anus would suck the poison up out of the wound.
Wait a second. How would a rooster's anus cure ever catch on in the first place? I mean, it wouldn't work.
Well, yeah, but if you think about it, not every rabid dog or bat bite is actually going to transfer the virus.
In the sense that, you know, the saliva just will fail to get the virus where it needs to be.
So every so often, the healer's going to come along with his rooster's anus and, you know, put it on your wound, and
sure enough,
it works.
Case closed. We have our rabies cure.
Ah.
So you're saying that Pliny's list is a lot of lucky accidents by sorcerers.
Yeah, I think that lucky accidents were kind of probably what kept some of these things kicking around long enough to become accepted.
Well, what do we know about rabies for real? I mean, what do we actually know about the disease?
I mean, not much. We know it's a very unusual virus.
Yeah. The way a typical virus travels is it has a port of entry, it replicates locally, it makes it into the bloodstream, it circulates widely, it finds its target tissues, and then it replicates
right,
there.
Right, exactly.
So you get a wound, it gets infected, that goes into the blood. But rabies?
It enters the body at the bite wound site.
Say in Gina's case, the tip of her finger.
It binds to a nerve right there.
To a particular receptor.
And then crawls its way up the nervous system.
1 to 2 centimeters per day.
I think that's right, to attack the brain.
It literally grabs onto the nerve and climbs up?
It's like hand over hand. Wow. Might take a few days to go the length of a finger, maybe 3 weeks to go the length of an entire arm.
It's during that slow climb that we can administer vaccine and help the body mount an immune response.
If you give a person the vaccine before they see symptoms, while the virus is still climbing its way up to the brain, they should be okay.
But once the infection has taken root in the brain, then it's too late for vaccination.
The moment you have a twitchy finger, the moment you have like the slightest little flu-like symptom, which will later progress into rabies, that's the moment that you know you're going to die of that disease.
Well, what does the virus do when it gets to the brain?
Well, it's very much not known specifically what happens in the brain. it might start shutting parts of your brain down. In about 30% of the cases, the muscles might start to kind of get paralyzed. It's called paralytic rabies. Eventually, their entire body will get paralyzed and they might just slump into a coma. Or more often, it's that cliche of the rabies death is what actually happens, where people have these like spasms of rage. There are videos online where you can see people in this state.
Yeah, YouTube.
I find them impossible to watch.
People, you know, just screaming and writhing in convulsions.
And from the virus's perspective, it's trying to drive its host to be more aggressive so that it bites somebody else and spreads more virus. Huh. The other thing that is, I find, really perverse is that they will get this fear of water, a really powerful fear of water.
The human victim of rabies tries to drink, wants to drink.
But then they'll bring the cup to their hands and they just shake and overflow.
The muscles in their throat seize up.
A gag reflex.
And they can't.
They can't drink water?
Yeah. You can imagine, though, again, from the virus's perspective, why that would be advantageous. You are trying to transmit virus through biting. So an animal who can't swallow his virus-filled saliva.
They're going to be like a loaded gun.
Right.
And eventually, after a few days in these late stages, person might lapse into a coma, have a heart attack. There's really any number of ways they could die.
That sounds awful.
And it was.
So when the official results came back, and Rodney took Gina's mom and dad, Ann and John Geezy, into a room and told them,
"We're sorry, but she has rabies,
and it's definitely too late for the vaccine."
John and I both started crying. You know, is there anything that can be done? And one of the doctors said, "There's nothing we can do. We can either put her in a dark room and let her die. You can take her home and let her die." And we're just, this can't be happening.
They said, what else do you got? And they said, well, we can do standard intensive care. Well, does that work? Well, no. What else do you have?
And then Dr. Willoughby said,
okay, well.
Well, I do have an idea. I'd like to try this. I don't even know what he called it.
Okay, so the night before, while they were waiting for the test results, hoping it wasn't rabies, Rodney started calling around.
You know, I actually called the CDC asking if there was anything that was unpublished but promising.
They say no.
And then I essentially headed to the library. And what I did is I pulled, I don't know, about 20 years worth of case reports.
Started reading.
Sounded pretty hopeless. But
he does notice one thing. He sees mention in this one kind of obscure paper.
I read one article that said, well, this might be a disorder of neurotransmission.
That maybe what's happening in the brain during rabies is something called excitotoxicity. Excitotoxicity.
Excitotoxicity.
Yeah.
Sounds exciting and maybe toxic. What is it?
Well, excitotoxicity, and this is tricky stuff. And it's controversial. And
yeah, this is the kind of thing that actually makes rabies researchers at conferences get into fights with each other. Here's a basic idea. You might think that a brain infection just physically destroys the brain.
Yeah.
But under this theory, the brain isn't physically destroyed. It's just that the neurons themselves are getting overstimulated, overexcited, and then that part of the brain is disrupted, and it all just kind of shuts down.
Just making it impossible for the brain to function properly. And so the sort of life-sustaining functions of the brain, like
breathing and, you know, circulating blood,
they stop working because the neurons that control them are just overwhelmed.
Right.
In other words,
rabies doesn't destroy the brain. It disrupts the brain.
The brain itself is spared.
So it's like a software problem, not a hardware problem.
Yeah. And what Rodney read is that people had died of rabies, and in the autopsy, their brains looked totally fine.
Entirely normal.
Moreover,
the virus was gone.
You couldn't even detect the rabies virus in their brain.
Brain no longer had rabies in it.
Really?
Yeah, it was like there was no weapon at the scene of the crime.
So that was my clue.
What that suggested to Rodney is that the immune system does eventually turn on.
Right.
And it kicks in.
Oh.
And it starts fighting the disease, but it just gets there too late.
So the immune system had all the tools, but essentially this virus beat your immune system to the punch. It would kill you faster than the immune response could eradicate it.
Because the virus moves, what, more quickly than the immune system?
Way faster.
And to me, it was like, well, you know, the solution there is obvious. And
if you could buy Gina's immune system some time.
Enough time, you could clear the brain and the brain would not be damaged.
She might survive. So what he suggests to Anne is that he put Gina into a coma.
Put her into a coma.
Induce a coma. And if an anesthesiologist is controlling routine brainstem activities like
breathing, circulation,
then
no matter what the virus is actually doing inside her brain, he might be able to keep her alive
long enough for the immune system to make a response, which would take normally about 7 to 10 days.
And this is still kind of a guess.
This is entirely improvised, yeah. And lots of things can go wrong, and when they go wrong, they typically go wrong badly.
He knows there's a huge risk that she's going to end up being brain dead or maybe locked in.
And that's worse than death, I think, in everybody's eyes.
Were you nervous about the possibility, like he said she could end up being a vegetable, just like she'd be survived?
I don't think I thought that far ahead. I thought more of, let's just keep her alive, get the disease out of her.
So they put Gina into a coma. Rodney figures we'll give her a week, and then we'll check to see if she has an immune response.
And once they had her hooked up to with the coma, she had the pole with all the IV stuff on and the different medications and stuff.
Anne stays with Gina in the hospital room and spends her time
praying and calling people and asking them to pray. And
she repeated this one prayer,
Psalm 91,
over and over again.
It talks about, you know, basically the devil not getting a hold of you.
He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence.
And so we were just waiting.
He will cover you with his feathers.
Waiting.
And under his wings you will find refuge.
It was probably the most uncomfortable feeling I've ever had in medicine.
7 days in, they sample her spinal fluid, send it in for testing, and then they get the results, which say?
Her antibody response is in and going up.
Her immune system is working.
Yeah, it was working, and in fact, we now had rabies antibody, and we had a fair amount of it, and it was in the spinal fluid, meaning it's around the brain. And so, essentially, the plan worked. So we said, well, okay, let's start waking her up.
But as they're waking her up, she has a fever.
And they couldn't figure out what was causing the fever.
So they put her back under for another week. And then finally, they start to wake her up again.
And she gradually, you know, woke up.
Her brain activity looked great, and she had nice pupils, but physically, she did not move a muscle.
They'd pinch her, they'd poke her.
She had no movement anywhere other than her pupils.
So she was responding to light? And
light,
that's it.
And this was the one thing that Rodney was most afraid of. That Gina was
a lock-in. Essentially locked inside this box of a body. And it was the worst day of my life. Because it looked like she'd probably gonna survive, and we'd actually done worse than death.
And as Rodney drove back and forth from work, he kept repeating this one prayer.
Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a poor sinner. Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a poor sinner. Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a poor sinner. And then about 2 days later,
Rodney's in the hospital. He's looking over Gina's charts.
You know, just checking her exam. And
another doctor was finishing up her shift, and she comes over to Rodney.
Said, oh, did you know that she had reflexes today? And I said, no.
Rodney grabs a reflex hammer.
And then sure enough, she had knee reflexes.
Next day,
her eyes started fluttering a little bit.
Within a week,
she was back.
For a couple weeks after I woke up, I still have no memory.
This is Gina Giese, the first person to survive rabies without the vaccine.
My first memory was actually Thanksgiving Day.
a couple weeks after she woke up from the coma.
Back in 2004, I just remember being with my family and playing board games with my brothers and just them being there and then going down to the cafeteria for dinner, mm-hmm. and having fish. I remember we had fish.
How long was she in the hospital for?
About 2 months.
I had to learn how to stand and then to walk, to turn around, to move my toes. I was really, after rabies, you know, a newborn baby who couldn't do anything. And then I had to relearn that all.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that feeling?
Yeah, mentally I was there, you know. Mentally I knew how to do stuff, but my body wouldn't cooperate with what I wanted it to do. And it was frustrating. Yeah. And it definitely took a toll on me psychologically. You know, I'm still recovering. I'm not completely back.
She can't play volleyball anymore, but she finished high school, went to college.
I graduated with a degree in just general biology.
And now Gina is really into bats.
She's a bat lover.
Yeah.
If I ever go down to the zoo, you know, they let me go behind and in with the bats and I can pet them and stuff.
Really?
Yeah, I'll feed them, I'll pet them. I've been going to bat festivals here in Wisconsin,
Yeah. So
I have no fear of bats.
That would be the last person I would expect to go to a bat festival.
Oh, this girl is a saint, that's all.
She is the poster child for what became known as the Milwaukee Protocol.
That's the name of Rodney's thing that he did with her?
Yeah.
You mean that this has been tried again?
This has been tried all around the world by different people and different versions of it, but it's been tried around 30 times.
With what result?
So everything I'm about to say forward, there's debate about every single little bit of it. But he says five survivors.
Five survivors?
Yeah.
Out of how many people?
Out of about 30 people. Which, on the one hand, seems like a terrible, you know, percentage for a treatment for a disease, 5 out of 30. But on the other hand, this is rabies, and you know, for all of human history, it was 0 out of 30.
Was there anything about the five that separates them from the others?
Well, this brings us to the really murky territory.
You know, rabies has been one of those just really interesting pathogens to me. The more you think you know about it, the more you don't know about it.
This is Amy.
Dr. Amy Gilbert. I'm a research biologist at the National Wildlife Research Center here in Fort Collins.
So this gets to your question, Robert. A couple years ago, Amy actually went to study rabies in Peru with this guy.
I am Sergio Recuenco, a physician by profession.
Just so happens Sergio is also from Peru.
I was born in Lima.
And he now works as an epidemiologist at the CDC. But in 2010, they traveled deep into the Amazon jungle.
First from Lima, we have to travel to Tarapoto, and from Tarapoto go to...
I mean, we're talking remote.
8 hours from Yurimaguas to San Lorenzo on the...
What were they looking for?
Well, they were studying bat-borne diseases, and in that part of the world, people have a lot of contact with vampire bats.
So we choose two towns.
Chirinacocha and Santa Marta.
So they arrive and go door to door.
Household to household.
We visit each house and talk with one member of the family.
And they'd ask, you know, have you been bit by a vampire bat? Have you had any illnesses? Then they'd take a blood sample. And what they found is basically rabies front page news.
11% of the blood samples that were tested.
7 people out of 63.
Had what we call evidence of virus neutralizing antibodies.
They had rabies antibodies in their blood.
Okay.
Well, you know how I mentioned that sometimes the body will mount a response to rabies, but it's just too late?
Yeah.
So you might see those antibodies, but only when somebody's dying, right?
Yeah.
And these people in Peru, they had the antibodies.
But we didn't have any evidence there was any neurological disease in any of the cases.
They didn't seem to have rabies.
But we're really very surprised.
I'm sorry, why?
Well, think about it. The only way they could have gotten those antibodies in their blood was...
by contact in some point with the virus.
They'd come into contact with rabies, and yet they were fine. It was almost as if they were immune to rabies.
Huh.
Well, I...
But Amy won't use that word, immune, because...
The data are sort of inconclusive as to whether there was any entry into the brain.
Like, they didn't know if the virus made it all the way into these people's brains, and so did they come down with full-blown rabies or not? They don't know. But it's possible that these people are special. Some people even argue
that there are special individuals who are able to survive rabies.
And not just in Peru. Monica told me about another case.
The Texas wild child, the rabies case, laboratory confirmed, in a girl in Texas.
17-year-old girl.
A runaway.
She shows up in 2009 at a hospital in Houston. She has a headache, her neck hurts, and she's really agitated. They confirmed that it was rabies, but she
didn't receive the Milwaukee protocol or any critical care measures.
As far as we know, they just figured she would die. But then 3 weeks later, this girl
went on, you know, to walk out of the hospital.
She just got better.
No drugs, no coma, nothing?
On her own.
Hmm. Wow.
And this actually brings us back to Gina.
She's pretty close to normal.
Because at the point when she arrived at the hospital to see Rodney,
he actually was diagnosed as having small amounts of antibody in her.
She already had antibody in her blood, like those people in Peru.
She did not have recoverable virus.
We could not isolate virus from her.
Which is unusual.
It does seem that she is immunologically special.
In fact, if you look at all of the people who have gotten the Milwaukee protocol and survived, they all have that profile.
Like the girl in Texas, like Precious Reynolds.
That's another girl who got the Milwaukee protocol and survived.
They have had similar lab work come back. Mm. Those patients, you know, have extraordinary lab work and extraordinary outcomes.
And so some researchers in Canada and Thailand have argued that Rodney's protocol actually had very little, if nothing, to do with Gina Giese surviving. They would say she survived.
Despite Dr. Willoughby's treatment rather than because of Dr. Willoughby's treatment.
Oh, so they're accusing him of basically pulling a rooster's anus kind of number.
I don't think they would, you know, really put it that way. Exactly. They say that the Milwaukee protocol should be discontinued and that we shouldn't be wasting time and money on it.
You know, they in Bangkok are acutely aware of the fact that to do one Milwaukee protocol case, you could vaccinate, I think it was all of the kids in Bangkok, preventatively against rabies.
Yeah, tens of thousands of slum kids in Bangkok could be preventatively vaccinated against rabies.
So these critics would say, you know, give people vaccines, but don't induce a coma and don't use these untested drugs that Rodney administers. And if somebody comes in with an advanced case of rabies, well, unless you have evidence that they're one of these immunologically special people, you just need to accept the fact that they're going to die.
I think, no. Calling not to do anything, I will definitely disagree. We have to do something.
According to Sergio, the idea that Rodney somehow just got incredibly lucky when he was treating Gina Giese,
that's very unlikely.
Gina was basically at death's door.
So there are some things might not be fully understood in Gina Giese's case, but it was obvious that if she was not given this alternative, she might not have survived.
And you could argue that if Gina's part of this immunologically special group of people who can just survive rabies without the vaccine, then how come nobody did before Rodney came along?
You know, this is really not science. This is right now storytelling. There's something right, but we still don't know, and we won't know until we figure out which parts work and don't work.
You know, for now, Rodney's forced to evaluate and try to improve the protocol just one patient at a time. Without the funding or research that he wants. So, you know, no clinical trials, no animal models.
So we're left learning the hard way, which is an awful way to learn.
Whatever the case, you've actually got to be glad that Rodney gave Gina a shot. Because whether or not you think that he saved her life or she saved her own life, the fact is that at least now we know that rabies isn't quite the killer that we once thought it was. He took it off of its throne of death. Even if, you know, just a little bit, maybe.
And when we say, you know, rabies is coming off, it's 100% thrown, it's, you know, down to 99.999. You know, like, it's...
it might be that it was never quite on that throne.
Yeah,
exactly, ever.
Right.
All right, well, we've certainly cleared things up. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure thing.
Thanks also to Ashvin Shaw for research help, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Claire calling from Beijing. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're talking about death, about the big D.
Yeah. And in the last section, we had a guy who tried to beat the deadliest disease known to man.
But I can one-up that because I talked to a guy who thinks that one day we will be able to beat death, period. End of sentence. Remember when we were at Harvard and we were talking to George Church?
George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School.
Excellent. We were doing the show about bioengineering.
So here's an example where we might grow up a large batch of cells in a fermenter.
Yeah. George Church was the guy who was trying to use little bacteria to make gasoline.
A couple of liters.
He is manipulating life.
Right.
He also flirts around with the idea of eliminating the concept of death.
I disagree that there is a quantum leap between living and non-living. I think there's a continuum between non-living and living. And you can create all sorts of things.
Wait. At some point, like, if I were to shoot you in the head,
yeah,
and you were to fall on the floor with a hole in your head and bleed, and I have no nurse or no doctor help you, at some point, your state will have changed fundamentally. You'll stop breathing, and you'll be over.
But I won't necessarily...
Yes, you will be dead.
I'm saying that depending on the probability of a doctor coming into the room and fixing me and the probability of more advanced technology being able to reverse all kinds of pathological damage, there's a value to saying that there is a continuum between life and death. And
I'll give you the continuum, but I'm also saying that there will be a certain point at which you are unmistakably over.
With current technology. But not necessarily with future technology, and there may be.
I mean, you're saying that it is possible that you can never be totally dead; that might be a reversible state at some point.
Well, if we recorded the position of all my atoms, and we could recreate those position of all those atoms, you could completely burn me into atoms and then reassemble. And isn't it the end? I'm alive again.
Yes, I suppose in a conceptual way, if you get to be really, really, really clever, I guess you could reverse everything. But maybe we could never get that clever. Or do you think that?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to boil down to cost. You know, the idea of death implies that there is a sharp point at which a point of no return. And I'm saying this gets harder and harder and harder.
But not impossible.
And I don't see that as particularly impossible. I mean, if you've recorded the state of the living thing before it starts going into this impossible decay, you just start from scratch and you build it from scratch. Nothing is really completely lost. Nothing is completely gained. The main thing that is retained through all this is the information.
And George Church thinks that being alive is having all that information. So, Jad?
Mm.
If I knew where all your atoms are right now, you could always come back. That's his view. Oh, God. Come back.
It's a terrible thought for you, isn't it?
For my taste, there's a much more pleasant way to think about it.
What's that?
The other way to think about it is to think like Bernd Heinrich, a professor at the University of Vermont, who got a curious letter, and a wonderful letter, I think, from a student of his named Bill.
He was a grad student in entomology at UC Berkeley when I was teaching there, and he came out and visited at the camp in Maine.
Bernd, you see, has a cabin in the western part of Maine up on top of a mountain. It's actually very beautiful, set in the woods of spruce and pine. Bill, the grad student, did spend some time there, and then he moved back to Southern California, and a few years passed, and then this letter arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sense that there was anything wrong before you got the letter, or was this out of the blue?
No, I had no sense whatsoever, no. He was hale and hearty, and then I got that letter.
So here's how the letter went. It begins, "Yo, Bernd, I have been diagnosed with a severe illness, and I'm trying to get my final disposition arranged in case I drop sooner than I hoped. I want an Abbey burial." This phrase, Abbey burial, refers to a guy named Edward Abbey, who was a very, very famous ecologist and who was brought into the desert by his best friends in a sleeping bag right after he died
and just put in the ground, no embalming, no coffin, lightly covered with sand, and that's where they left him. That is what Bill wanted to have happen. Anyhow, the upshot is, he wrote, one of the options is burial on private property. What are your thoughts on having an old friend as a permanent resident at the camp? Signed, Bill. In other words, Bill wanted to be laid out on the ground, not even under the ground, at Burnt's place in Maine.
I wrote him, I don't think I would want to have him laid out in front of my camp in Maine. I think that's, although, you know, if it was a wilderness where, you know, people are not going to be walking around, then I would think more favorably of it. I think right now, I don't think we want to have carcasses lying around in the woods. You know, I definitely don't think that.
But he did write Bill this. He wrote, I read you loud and clear. When it's my turn, I too want no less for myself. A casket would be for you, as it was for Edward Abbey, an unacceptable cage for otherwise free and ever recycling molecules that would soon become incorporated into the Earth's ecosystem.
You know, I agree with the idea. I just feel that, you know, being sealed up and totally removed from all the natural processes that normally occur with every animal on Earth is very somehow frightening. It seems unnatural, and I don't know, it just...
It's funny that you'd use the word frightening. I think most people lock themselves up in a casket because they're frightened to be munched on by worms and beetles and things.
Yeah. No, I don't find that frightening at all. I find that comforting to be part of the ecosystem, to be composed into grass, to be composed into ravens, to be composed into flowers and trees. You know, that's a comforting thought to me.
That's the other way to think about it, is that you're releasing yourself for the chance to be lots and lots and lots and lots of different, new, and more beautiful lives that will succeed you, which...
I don't know.
Well, wait. I would say that if I could become plants and new animals...
What, would that make you swoon?
No, it would make me feel like I'm a collection of molecules. I'm here for a season, 60, 70, 80 years, whatever, and then I... let my molecules go, I disappear, and the molecules go on to new adventures.
Yeah, but that there's some, but then you're gone.
Yeah, I'm gone.
You're lost.
Well,
that was here for 60, 70, 80 years, whatever, is suddenly not here anymore, and there is in that an absence. There's a vacancy. Don't you feel that? I mean, I love for the Beatles and the things and everyone to be together again. But there is also the sense that when you disappear, you're gone. You're not, I mean, I understand on some level what George Church was saying to you. I mean, why, if you've got the technology, would you want to lose something so precious as a friend or a family member or a lover or something or a co-host when you can bring that person back?
Well, can you really bring them back? I mean, or maybe they're like past their sell-by date. You know, like that. Don't you have a feeling sometimes that when it's time, it's time?
And
if
I
you
do, can
keep
actually.
Being brought back, you'd like be a prisoner of technology. like you're being forced into a continuous existence, which you may not want.
I totally agree with that. I was just being argumentative a second ago, and particularly agree because sometimes what it takes to keep you there is worse than being gone.
Yeah.
As we'll hear in our next segment,
right after this break.
Hi, it's Mary Bouchard, calling from the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, the show is about dead reckoning.
And you know, if we're going to do a show called Dead Reckoning, we might as well talk to people who deal with death every day.
So this is practical people dealing with this problem quite practically.
But not in the way you would expect.
Not at all. This one comes from our producer, Sean Cole.
Well, this story starts with a doctor. A guy named Joseph Gallo.
Hello?
Can you hear me, Joe?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I feel like a celebrity. You're sending a sound person here.
Joe's an MD, but he's also a professor
at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
And he's been working on a study that I just frankly find totally fascinating.
Let me, if I ramble, just stop me. But
so here's the story. A long time ago,
in the 1940s and early 50s,
Johns Hopkins launched something called the Precursor Study. And all of these graduating medical students,
1,337 students,
signed up
between 1948 and 1964.
And every one of them agreed to be poked, prodded, examined up and down.
You know, their blood pressure, their weight.
Asked all these questions.
Their habits, how much exercise they took. They did Rorschach ink blot tests.
Wow. And what was the point of this study? Well, originally it was just to pinpoint the precursors to heart disease. But over time, the study went way beyond that. And the researchers started asking all sorts of other questions.
Questions about depression, anxiety.
Like 50 years of this study, and the doctors are getting older and older.
Social
and
support, retirement.
At a certain point, about 15 years ago, Joe and the other researchers start to ask these doctors about death.
So if you have that paper in front of you.
Yeah, hang on. Essentially, what they did was they presented the doctors, many of whom are now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, with the following scenario.
The scenario is there.
It says, and it goes something like this. So say you have brain damage or some brain disease that can't be cured. You can't recognize people. You can't speak understandably. And you're in this condition for a long time.
Like you're brain dead.
Well, you're not brain dead, but it kind of describes maybe a scenario that's like severe dementia.
And then it says, indicate your wishes regarding the use of each of the following medical procedures.
There's a list, 10. CPR, IV fluids, major surgery.
There's a bunch of them.
So the question they're asking is, if I'm in this terrible situation, would I want these things?
Would you agree to have these things done to you if it came down to it?
Right.
Okay.
So what would you say as an example?
You're asking us now?
Yeah, yeah. And I also put the question to a bunch of people in the street.
Excuse me, sir. My name's Sean Cole. I'm a reporter with...
Well, give me one.
So CPR, for example. So your heart stops CPR.
Would I want CPR?
Yes.
Well, yeah. I want somebody to do that.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yes.
Seems like a no-brainer.
What about mechanical ventilation? It's a breathing machine.
A breathing machine.
You're going to die if you don't get it.
Well,
maybe.
Then yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yes. Yes.
Sure. Yeah, I wouldn't say don't do it, yeah.
You remember all of them. Kidney dialysis.
Dialysis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? So.
Yeah. Feeding tube?
Yes.
Yep.
Major surgery?
I don't know.
Like a gallbladder operation? If we're just talking about the gallbladder.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Antibiotics?
Yeah.
Totally.
Sure.
IV hydration?
Yes.
Absolutely.
You would want all that?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, and yes.
That's what most people say. They want most everything. I mean, maybe not some of the super invasive stuff, but generally, yes.
Okay.
On the other hand, you ask the doctors what they want, same situation, brain dead or brain injured, whatever. Do they want CPR?
90% say no. They would not want CPR.
Really?
90%?
Whoa. No, yeah. I mean, and I asked a bunch of doctors at a vascular health conference here in New
each
York.
Each of the following medical procedures.
And they said the same thing.
CPR.
No CPR.
No.
No CPR.
No CPR.
And almost 90% wouldn't want ventilation.
No.
Or dialysis.
Definitely not.
No.
80% would not want surgery.
Well, no.
80% would not want invasive testing.
No.
Almost 80% wouldn't want a feeding tube.
What?
No.
And then pain medicine is the one that's a bit different.
The actual item on the survey reads, would you opt for pain medications even if they dull the consciousness and indirectly shorten my life?
There, 80% of them say...
Yes.
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 Pain reliever, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah, painkiller, yes.
Yes.
Pain medication, yes. Yeah.
So pain medication that's all they want?
For the most part, yeah.
Why would there be such a big gap between doctors and patients?
Well.
Hi, is that you?
It's me.
Great to meet you.
You also, Sean.
How are you doing?
It started to become clear to me when I talked with Ken Murray. He's also a doctor.
And you're in your Dr. White's here?
I thought I'd impress you.
I met up with him at a hospital in Los Angeles. He's written a bunch of articles now about how doctors want to die.
This exact question was asked.
So I asked him, like, why is there this difference, you know, particularly with something like CPR? What is it that doctors know that we're not aware of?
Well, we know
that CPR is basically pretty terrible as an intervention. It basically doesn't work very well. And people just don't believe that. They just can't believe it.
And for very good reason. There was a study done in 1996 about how many people survive CPR intervention on ER, Chicago Hope, Rescue 911. It's 96. Those are hot shows then. And so the researcher watched all of these medical dramas
and recorded what the result was.
Come on, you can do it. Come back to us, Don. Do it. Come on. 2, 3, 4.
And the answer was 75% of the time, people...
Come on. Okay, get the oxygen. Easy breath.
We're revived.
Come on, nice. Easy breath. Give it to her. Come
on. It works 75% of the time.
Easy breath. Easy breath, John.
The actual number is more like 8.
8%?
Roughly 8% survive to at least a month.
Wow.
And in fact, it's worse than that.
Here's how that 8% breaks down.
When you actually break it down, there was a fellow who did a study in 2010. He looked at 95,000 cases, actually more than that. And I think it was all the cases in Japan that year. And what he found was that about 3% had what you would call a good outcome. That is, return to a meaningful quality of life.
You and me sitting here talking and eating sandwiches.
Exactly. About the same number,
3% or so,
ended up in a chronic vegetative state. Not quite brain dead, but pretty close.
And the final 2%
were in some sort of intermediate level. Not good, but they weren't comatose. Everybody else was dead. That's the reality of it. And we physicians, we know that. We've actually done CPR. We have actually laid hands on the chest.
Here's something I didn't know. Ken says that when you do CPR, you often end up cracking the person's ribs.
Wow.
And yet that, according to Ken, is kind of mild in terms of some of the things that doctors put patients through.
I think a lot of times we're doing things to people that we wouldn't do to a terrorist.
Is that true or is that overstated?
I'm not kidding.
Like what kinds of things?
Well, paralyzing somebody so that you cannot move, which you generally have to do when you put a person on a ventilator, a breathing machine, a respirator. When you put somebody on one of these machines, it breathes for you. But the problem is you'll fight it because you'll have your own rhythm. So what happens is you have a person that is fighting, and you can't get air in and out of them. So you paralyze them.
So they stop fighting. You know, they can't move.
But it doesn't mean they're asleep. They're not asleep. They are completely helpless. And yet they're aware of everything that's going on around them.
Sounds nightmarish, actually.
Yeah.
Ken took me through a bunch of different situations, from congestive heart failure to lung disease and pancreatic cancer, where he feels basically that the treatment is like worse than the actual disease of what you have. It may be prolonging, but not for very long, and the life that you have left is misery.
Right.
In fact, Ken says that colleagues of his, other doctors,
they'll turn to me in the ICU and they say, if you find me like this, kill me. And they're not kidding.
He says there are doctors who wear medallions with the words "no code" stamped on them, which just means "don't resuscitate me." He's even seen tattoos that say "no code."
Okay. Can I talk to you now?
Yes.
Do you have any idea? Come on, turn that off. All right, Sean, can I just break in for 1 second?
Yeah.
Because while you were reporting this piece, a very strange coincidence happened to me. I was visiting my dad, and after dinner one night, he sits me down and he says, I have something important I want to tell you. I've signed an advanced directive, which basically means if I end up in the hospital, terminally ill or something, I don't want a lot of medical stuff done to me. I had not told him about your story at all.
Really?
Yeah. So it was just out of the blue.
And he shows you a piece of paper? Or?
No, not then. But I just saw him a couple days ago and asked him to read it to me because I hadn't actually seen it yet.
What does it say?
It says, I direct that medical care be withheld or withdrawn, and that I be permitted to die naturally with only the administration of medications.
You can skip over that paragraph.
I authorize the withholding of artificially provided food, intravenous fluids, and other nourishments.
If I cannot give directions regarding my medical care, I intend that my family and physicians honor this declaration as the final expression of my legal right to refuse medical care, and I accept the consequences of that refusal.
Yeah.
Huh. So pain medication is all you really want?
Yeah. To keep me comfortable.
So, it looks like the baby's crying. So you, it sounds like, why wouldn't you want artificially provided food, intravenous fluids, or other nourishment?
That's my choice.
I know, but that doesn't sound like it's that much of an intervention, really.
It is an intervention to sustain life unnecessarily. If I should ever have a terminal condition.
Would you want CPR done?
If I have a choice, the answer is no. Hmm.
But wouldn't you want Mom or I to be in a position where we can make the decision?
I mean, what if you conflict?
Like she feels one way, I feel another?
Yeah.
You tell me this is one of the worries that doctors have, that, you know, they'll have talked to the patient or the patient's family, explain the situation carefully, and everyone's agreed, no more interventions. But then a random family member will just show up, you know, like a cousin or an estranged son or daughter, maybe carrying a lot of guilt. And they're like, no, doc, you have to do whatever it takes.
At the end of the day, I give the option to the patient and to the family to make a decision. That's what I have to do.
Except in this case, when the patient is him.
But by having this means we have to honor this, right? We can't. We can't have our own feelings about it.
You can have your own feelings, but you still have to honor this.
But it's just the thing that gives me pause is that, I mean, you're a doctor. Your job is to prolong life and to sustain life, and you choose not to when it comes to your own life.
Nobody said my job is to sustain life. My job is to sustain life when it is possible. It is not to sustain life when it's futile. And if you're going to sustain my life on a respirator, I don't want it. That kind of life, I do not want.
More than anything, the thing he wanted to make sure of is that he does not die in a hospital. He definitely does not want to die at the place where he works.
That's something that came up a few times among the doctors at the conference that I went to.
You know, I think I don't want to die in a hospital bed.
This is Tim Ryan, a resident at Cleveland Clinic.
Why not?
Because I see patients and patients' families suffer tremendously, and I think we do a poor job of communicating futility to them. I don't know how to communicate that effectively.
You know, though, there is one thing that struck me, though, talking to my dad. There's a question that patients will sometimes ask that can be a kind of bridge between doctors and patients. Very often, he says, when people are in the middle of this decision, they'll turn to him and they'll say, Doc, what would you do if this was your mother or father? And he says, when they ask the question that way, it creates an entirely different conversation. He can say, here's what I would honestly do. Or in fact, and I did not know this, here's what I actually did.
It happened with my parents. When my father fell and developed complications as a result of the fall.
He says he called the doctor and told him no more medical interventions.
And he ended up dying comfortably. Same thing happened with my mother. I had discussed it with my mother and my father when they were not sick. This was a plan. I can tell you in 90% of the patients that I see, such planning doesn't happen.
I had a habit for most of my career when I'd have a new patient come in, particularly over the age of 50, I'd ask him, how do you want to die?
And this is Ken Murray again.
You know, a lot of them, you know, you give me kind of a funny look. That's an odd question for a doctor to be asking me. And I said, well, you know, it's the one thing we can be sure of that's going to happen eventually. And I want to make sure it happens the way you want. And so people, you know, the typical answer is, well, I'd like to die in my sleep, you know, painlessly. I mean, what actually is that? That's usually a heart attack, or stroke, something of that nature, that happens just like that, and you're gone.
And that's what we and our doctors are essentially doing everything in our power to avoid. So, like, when you ask people in the abstract, they're saying,
how do I want to die? Peacefully.
I want to die peacefully. I want to die in my sleep and everything like that. But when you ask them the specifics, you hear,
no.
Pound on my chest, stick a tube down my throat. So it's this paradox.
Well, it sounds to you like a paradox, but think about it. It could be, it's so healthy to do both, even at the same time. It's healthy to want to stay, and it's healthy to know how to be ready to go. I was listening to a Fresh Air sort of retake, and they had Maurice Sendak on the air, who died not too long ago. Before he died, he was on Fresh Air.
That's an amazing interview.
Yeah. And Terry Gross was talking to him, and he's sitting there in his Connecticut house looking out the window at a tree. And he says to Terry, I am so in love with the tree and the beauty of it and my chance to keep it company just a little while longer. And I want to stay. And every extra day I get is a day that's precious to me and makes me want to stay even harder. But he says to Terry, I am ready to go when it's time. I've made myself ready. Mm-hmm. And that compromise you make with yourself, to love it with your whole soul and yet at the same time say, I'll know when it's over and I'm composed enough and prepared enough to take my exit. That's what a good death is.
Thank you, Sean Cole.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for listening.
Start of message.
Radiolab is produced by my son, Chad Abumrad.
Hey guys, it's Sean Cole. Here we are with the credits.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn,
Lauren Wheeler, Tim Howard,
Brenna Farrell, Molly Webster,
Melissa O'Donnell, Dylan Keith, Jamie York,
Kelsey Padgett, Lynn Levy,
and Andy Mills. Hope that's nice. Okay, bye-bye.
End of message.